No.
You got a mother and a child.
Not until the child's born.
Right.
That's what
it goes in, and if it goes, I don't think that math comes out. It goes until they're how old?
2 years.
Two years.
In the first year, three years in the second year of the biennium.
Average months in, or how much?
For the mother during her pregnancy, we're assuming...
That's 12, that's 9 months.
We're assuming 6 months on the average.
Okay, that's my six then.
For the children, we're assuming once they're eligible, that they're generally eligible. The average is 21 months because the family's income changes.
Is the mother eligible after the child's born?
No, she's not.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This statement on the second page of your document, Oregon's postnatal death rate is third highest.
Wait a second. We haven't even gotten to this yet.
Well, I want to go just as soon as I get their questions about that first report. Okay. Let's move and let Christine go through this and then ask questions about it. Okay? Christine.
Okay. We did not succeed in getting you the chart, I think, that we envisioned as we were here.
Let me stop. Remind the committee, what I asked was to see if there could be a graphic representation of the alleged or the assumptions upon which this program is based as to its effect in preventing underweight, premature, and children who will have problems after birth.
The critical piece is included in the first three numbers at the top of the first page. On the average, 5% of births in Oregon are children of low birth weight. Low-risk mothers, who are mothers who are married, have a high school education, over 18, run a 3% rate. Medicaid-supported mothers run 10% of low birth weight, a rate of 10% of their births being of low birth weight. Low birth weight babies are very expensive. They tend to die in the first year of life. They tend to run up large hospital bills, cause a number of other problems. That risk is not an arc across the poverty level. I suppose if our statistical and research techniques were better, we could show that it's worse the poorer you get. But in fact, it is pretty much evenly a risk to women who are at that low end of the income scale. And these women who are up to the 100% of federal poverty level, from the point of view of risk of low birth weight, look pretty much like all of welfare-supported or Medicaid-supported mothers. So what we looked at was the fact that if we could get the prenatal care program in place so that we could reduce the low birth weight rate in Medicaid-supported mothers, not all the way to the low-risk mothers or even all the way to the state average, but just by 3 percentage points from 10% down to 7%, and you applied that across all of the women we've looked at here, you would have 310 fewer low birth weight babies. And that would mean, to the best of our ability to calculate, 15 fewer deaths in the first year of life. And it's very easy to start adding up the dollar savings there. The curve or the cutoff point then, Mr. Chairman, is to say, however far out toward 100% of poverty you can go, if you can get 80% of the way there, then you can look at reducing 80% of 310 low birth weight babies. And if you can only go 50%, you'll only get partway along. If we only improve care to the mothers we are now caring for, that is the present Medicaid mothers and the present medically needy, that gets at somewhere in the high 70% of the women shown here, and that would get you a cut of about, instead of 310 fewer low birth weight babies, maybe 240 fewer low birth weight babies. I think that's the best way to look at it based on what we know today. I do want to add that if we are successful in the improvement we've talked about, a Medicaid mother will be on prenatal care longer than 6 months. That's one of the problems with them. So their average enrollment will increase to 7 months maybe even 8 months if we could really drive it, so that they're getting prenatal care as early as the average low-risk mother. That's one of the critical features we are after.
What's
that
the,
could affect their
what's the additional cost of an additional, say, 2 months of prenatal care?
If it's billed in a package, there isn't a cost of the care because they pay for it as a package. There's some administrative cost in the two extra months they've got to process them through the system to make certain that they really are poor enough to be there. And for these additional services that we will be billing separately, a visit for additional nutritional counseling, an extra visit for parenting education, you might run up somewhere in the neighborhood of, from what I've seen, somewhere up to $100 a month extra billing on for those couple of months for those extra separately billable services. But that would be a very generous estimate based on what I've seen there.
I want to ask one more question. Can it be assumed that this kind of prenatal care that is the principal factor in determining the percentage of low birth weight babies?
That is the prenatal care, complete effective prenatal care, is the single most determining factor that can be identified going back through what are the differences. And it's because of identifying early the need for additional nutrition, or identifying early the need for bed rest, or identifying early some particularly complicated medical problem that needs to be directed over to a specialist. All of those things in combination.
If this is true, why, when that prenatal care is supplied, would you not presume that the percentage would be essentially identical to the state average? Because we must assume that many in the state average income are not getting adequate prenatal care.
I think that people who work more directly in prenatal care than I do could better answer this, but I believe they were being reasonably cautious in a promise here. Remember that I pointed out that we won't see the cumulative effect of this until the first full cycle of women who got enrolled right away in pregnancy come all the way through the system, and that'll be later on in this biennium. So we're not going to see this cumulative total start improving quickly in the first biennium of this program. But second, and I think it's more directly to the question you asked, is that these families can be hard to work with. The fact that somebody nice from the health department calls the mother up a day ahead of time and says, remember, it's your prenatal visit tomorrow, do get in, isn't automatically enough to get her in. And there is going to be a good deal of work in finding transportation and in making people feel that it's safe to come in all of those things. So that my understanding from the people who work with the program is that while they think we can get a program up and running and we can start making a dent in it, they aren't comfortable in saying, boy, we can just bring these people right down to the state average right out of the box with it.
So we can't be assured that because this care is available, and indeed because the individual enrolls in it, that they will necessarily follow through on it as religiously as one might hope.
That is correct. And that's why they think the 3 percentage point improvement is reasonable. And maybe farther than that when we really get into it in a big way, but not.
The other question I had was, might it be assumed that lower income mothers may have an established lifestyle which makes it more difficult for them to make the adjustments which provides for a perfect prenatal period and birth?
Yes, I think that is assumed in a number of instances. There certainly is information that use of cigarettes is higher in lower socioeconomic groups, that at least some abuse of substances may be higher, that they may be parts of a lifestyle that aren't quickly adjusted to, exercise patterns.
Long-established nutritional patterns.
All of those things.
So that those things might cause us not to be as successful even as a 7%.
They might. Although I think the people that worked on this were reasonably realistic, experienced people. But.
Okay.
That means you're going to keep very accurate data on the causes as you go through, I trust.
Yes, we are.
So that we can dissect out what the real problems are in this particular group.
One of the nice data sources we will have going online next year is a new standard birth certificate form that includes smoking history and alcohol history during pregnancy, so that for the first time we'll have a uniform data set on all deliveries about that risk factor.
What's Jeff Kirschner going to do to help you out on this if some of the problems is alcohol and drug related? Has he got monies available for the educational aspect of it?
I don't believe he has specific monies for that. He has been putting on training programs, and we have been encouraging nurses from local health departments to participate in programs as if they were branch offices within DHR to try and learn what some of the newer techniques and newer possibilities are. And I think if we identified a particular area here that Jeff would be open to exploring that. He's got quite an interest, for example, in preventing fetal alcohol syndrome in the newborn.
But your problem is not only training the professionals that are dealing with these people, but basically how to tap that level of educational level that you can get the information to them to where they respond.
That's correct.
You may even have literacy problems in some of this, too.
I think that may well be a part of it.
So you'll have to be building a whole different type of program.
That's correct. It's a different approach than we've been able to do before, and I think we'll be doing some feeling our way a little bit in the first year as we start putting it together.
Cliff, you had a question.
Yeah, it relates to this statement about our postneonatal death rate. And I wondered, do those figures include the abortion statistics?
No, these are children who make it to their first through the first 28 days of life and then die before their first birthday. And it is our belief that one of the reasons our rate is high, and it's more than a belief, it's based on the data we have available, that it's because Oregon's medical system is very, very good at keeping high-risk babies alive in that first 28 days in neonatal units and intensive places, but once they go home, they start having problems. And we'd like to stop them, find ways to have them be born healthy so we don't have that very high investment early and then problems later on.
And follow them home.
Yeah.
Well, before we finish this, you have some more questions on page 2. Before we finish this, let's look at the chart. These are Oregon statistics?
These are Oregon statistics.
The other four. 230. I think we have caucus. So it's
and the top line is a measure of inadequate care, which is based upon the number of visits.
And how late in the pregnancy they get their first visit.
What's the cutoff for inadequate care?
If they enroll in care later than the first trimester and they have less than
later than visits. first trimester?
Later than the first trimester.
Yeah.
So somewhere after the third month.
And have how many visits?
Less than five.
Less than five visits. Okay. And this chart tends to illustrate a close...
It's a Malthusian curve is what it is.
All right. Thank you very much. I have no further questions.
I'm not sure if this is playing me around, Mr. Chair.
Why are
we
chasing the native efforts?
I didn't hear the question.
It's because
why is the post-neonatal death rate so high?
Because our neonatal death rate is so low. Because we've been so good at saving those babies early. And we send them home from the nursery, but fragile, and then they don't make it. There are other causes, but that's the piece. As I've talked to our perinatologists and our people that really work on it, that seems to make one of the differences for Oregon, is that we're getting them into the high-risk nurseries, we're identifying them when they're born, giving them excellent care in that first 28 days.
Then they go home
and they don't make it. And that just seems, it's a terrible investment of resources to do it that way. It's very, very bad.
Because I would think in other states where this happens, this is not the case. It's some other factor. Right?
Yeah. Well, I also want to point out our SIDS death rate is a part of that. Oregon, as everybody knows, has one of the higher rates of sudden infant death syndrome. And so that, it tied in with the other problem, keeps ours up. Again, West Coast states seem to have a slightly higher rate, maybe in part related to our good statistics, but is an unknown factor that we haven't figured out how to solve yet. But SIDS deaths are higher in children who are born of low birth weight, who are born to teenage mothers, who have all the risk factors we're trying to identify. So we may, without directly knowing the exact tie-in, be able to provide some little dent in that with this program as well.
You have to leave at 2:30?
No.
Oh, you don't?
We'll stay with you until we're called, Mr. Chairman.
Well, all right, because we need to get to the civil commitment bill. And we have
You did announce today was the day that you would do public testimony on the prenatal care proposal also, right. And so there are people here.
Mary
Henrich.
Hennel, is it?
Henrich.
Henrich.
Yes, Ben.
H-E-N.
Quickrich. Two N's, R-I-C-H.
R-I-C-H, all right.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
I'm Mary Lou Henrich. I represent the Coalition of Local Health Officials, which is the organization of local health departments. And I'm very pleased to be here today to encourage you in your deliberations on this really important issue of prenatal care for low-income women up to 100% of poverty. And I, in fact, did help some of Christine's staff yesterday working on this couple pages. And don't have a lot of long testimony to give you because I, you know, having listened to your deliberations, I think you're really up to speed on the critical issues. I just want to assure you that the local health departments are ready and have been gearing up. This is probably, I was saying to Christine earlier, I think this is the fourth session that I've been at least peripherally involved in working on improving the access to prenatal care for low-income women. And if we can get it up to women up to 100% of the federal poverty level, I will die a happy woman. I have worked hard on this. I'm coming close to 40. I feel like it's going to happen. But no, I've got a long way to go. I've got a very long. I'm looking at your wonderful. Anyway, I'm just close to that this week, so I'm kind of in that phase of my life. But indeed, we have looked at, and the only, I didn't bring any written testimony, but I did bring a graph that we have worked on that does, I think, display for you the kind of groupings of women that we consider to be low income. And the federal WIC program covers women up to 185% of the poverty level. And you can see that right now, Medicaid and just regular ABC eligible are about 5,000 women, which is up to about 58% of the poverty level. Then last session, or session before, we got medically needy coverage, and that's that next group. And now today we're really talking about that 2,100 or so SOBRA or OBRA eligible women up to the 100%. And then there are still 9,000 more that health departments have been serving. And what we have done is worked every year trying to get more and more women to have that basic Medicaid coverage so they have choice in where they go, so they can have the full range of services available to them. And then health departments have continued to serve women who are either right above that level, and we will continue to do that. Right now there's about 17 county health departments that are doing direct prenatal care for low-income women. Last year we served about 3,000 women in county health departments. And then in addition to those ones that are doing it directly, the other counties, with the exception of, I think there's only three, that are not actively then contracting for services and doing some case management services if they aren't doing the whole package of prenatal care. And we've worked with private providers in all of our communities. And so wherever that line turns out to be, we just want you to know that the health departments are there to work in partnership with private providers, with the State Health Division, and with AFS to deliver as much care as we can. That's okay.
If we were able to fund this up to 100% of poverty level, how many more individuals would you then be able to provide services to up there among that 9,000?
Among that 9,000? I have to quickly...
Just roughly.
I think about 1,000.
About 1,000.
Yeah. I was trying to look for my sheet here on what the economic breakdowns of those 3,000 women we saw last year, but I think it would be between 750 and 1,000 more of those women above that eligibility.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I didn't quite understand it. I thought...
Well, the point is that right now they are moving down and covering a lot of these people that would now be covered under this bill, which would make their services then available for people above the 1,000, 100% of poverty level.
I thought I heard you say they are current, county health departments are now servicing about 3,000?
3,000 women.
So this would be an additional?
Well, it would be there would be two effects. One is some county health departments, Multnomah is one, I am from Multnomah County, where we do serve Medicaid-eligible population. So therefore, we would continue to serve some of those through our PCO. But the we kind of call it the Robin Hood theory, that when one person gets covered, paid for coverage, then we have other county general funds, state and federal maternal child health block grant funds that don't have to pay for that person who's now, you know, come sponsored. Mm-hmm. So that frees up the space for us to serve an unsponsored or uncovered individual. But in some counties where they don't serve Medicaid, they don't do that, they are just serving low-income women who don't have any kind of coverage. Some of those women who now have coverage can go off to the private sector, and they'll continue their program at the health department serving some of these other women who are now falling through the cracks and aren't getting care. Did that...
Well,
yes,
no. Are the county health department, does it cost them more if we do this because they're going to have to pay the full boat percentage?
Right now, county health departments, through a partnership between federal, state, and county dollars, are serving about 3,100 women.
Right.
Most of those women statewide do not have any medical coverage.
Right.
Okay. Some of those women will become eligible to be covered by this OBRA or SOBRA.
Right.
Those women will do one of two things. They'll go out to the private sector and see a private physician, since now they've got a medical card and have access. Okay, and that's probably, I'll go explain that one firstly. So when they move out, okay, then somebody else up here will move in to take their place. And that same funding that we've already got from county, state, and federal funds will continue, and this will not affect that funding. In fact, in some counties, the larger ones especially that are running prenatal programs that bill for Medicaid, there will be some more payment for some of those people, which will allow those programs to expand and serve not only those women, but out of those other funds, some of these other 9,000 women. And that's where I'm saying I think about 1,000 of those 9,000 women will get served, in addition to the ones you take care of, by this.
Yep.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Whitaker. I couldn't quite figure out the mathematics of that either.
Got there. Yes.
Karen?
I'm Karen Whitaker, representing the Oregon Medical Association. I'm not going to take very much of your time. I appreciate the opportunity to urge you to enrich the package of prenatal comprehensive maternity care services, both from a service component point of view and also from a provider reimbursement point of view. The handout that I've given you is a few charts from a report that I think I've already distributed to this committee. It's a survey that the OMA did of physicians in December of 86 and January of 87 that shows the current physician rate of Medicaid acceptance, and then the projected rate of acceptance in 1987 is at the bottom of the page. And as you can see, it declines dismally on the back sheet, back of the page, we can see the rate of percentage of physicians who plan to restrict their care of Medicaid patients during 1987, and that's 57.4%. There are basically two reasons why physicians are declining to accept Medicaid OB patients. One of them has to do with the rate of reimbursement, which is very low. At this point, they're getting about $501, and that doesn't come close to paying their costs of delivering the service. Their cost of delivering the service is around $750 to $800 just for their overhead. The other reason is that Medicaid patients, as you are well aware, are likely to be high risk for a number of reasons, some of them relating to their socioeconomic status, their nutrition, their educational status, their lifestyle, etc. I think by enriching the range and numbers of services for comprehensive maternity care and by getting these people into care at an earlier date, you're certainly also reducing that risk. We've not been able to resurvey the same physicians that we surveyed in December and January to see if this would make a difference to them. But I have done an informal telephone survey and have been assured by everyone that I've talked with that if they were to receive at least the cost of doing their services, at least $750 to $800 for a comprehensive package of services, that they would not decline to see Medicaid patients.
That's what I wanted to hear, because obviously this bill does propose roughly a doubling in the present rate. Do you think that that will reverse this decline?
I have had no one tell me that they would not continue to see Medicaid. Everyone that I talked with said they absolutely would if they could receive an increase in reimbursement.
Excellent. That's one of the tremendous features of this bill.
Yeah, it's an excellent bill. We are just 100% behind you and hope you're able to do it.
All right. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's the last of our witnesses on the prenatal care proposal. I can't assign a bill number to it. We haven't quite decided what the vehicle will be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Trost's advice is very good. I'm going to work on that. With that one amendment on excluding PCOs and HMOs from that freedom of choice, I'm going to put that in the Senate Bill 531, bring that back to you the next time you meet for passing it out. That frees up 543 as an unneeded bill now with the right relating clause relating to medical assistance. And you can use that for your prenatal care bill.
All right.
And I'll
that
do that.
Meets all our rules.
And I appreciate his counsel.
The rules are
on
changing,
that.
You know.
Yes. All right. We move now to a hearing on House Bill 2324.
Where have our people gone?
The hearing 23 you have.
Well, I know that we have. We're going to look at some amendments.
Didn't I say you didn't have to leave?
Okay. He said he did not have to leave. This civil commitment bill, House Bill 2324, has a subsequent referral to the Senate Judiciary Committee, or whatever we call it now. And Representative Kopetsky has some amendments that he's going to submit. These have been reviewed by Senator Frey because I wanted to make sure that we didn't duplicate efforts between the two committees. My understanding is that Senator Frey has looked at these amendments and feels that they are proper, and this should expedite swift passage through the Senate Judiciary Committee so that this can be reported to the floor. Perhaps we ought to look at the amendments first so that those who potential witnesses will know what the amendments are that we're considering so that they'll be able to comment on the bill as we propose to amend it.
Sure. Thank you. We have a civil rights problem with this bill.
Not that I know of. Yeah, well, we'll hear from.
You want me to explain?
Yes, Mike, would you explain these?
Mr. Chair, thank you. These amendments address one of the concerns of the district attorneys, and that is they would like, and I agree with the concept that what we ought to do, well, under the bill requires that the state's interest be represented in a commitment proceeding by counsel. Some counties do have the district attorneys there. Some counties have a county council there, and some counties don't have any counsel there. And so what you have is a situation where, in essence, the judge is acting as both a quote-unquote prosecutor, if you will, because there's a denial of liberty involved, and also the judge is acting as judge. And I think appearance-wise, this is not a good process, and certainly substantive-wise, it puts the judge in a quite uncomfortable, precarious position of having to serve both roles. What these amendments, and so the bill requires that that they be there, or a counsel for the state be there. And what the amendments do is it tells the counties, you shall decide if you want it to be the district attorney or a county counsel to be there, rather than just direct the state telling the district attorneys, district attorney.